Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the generals. Today, continuing my conversation with Thomas Ricks about his new book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. Ricks has been a reporter covering the military for the likes of the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal since the early 1980s. He's written a number of books, and this book looks at how American military traditions have evolved since the Second World War, especially traditions relating to firing or not firing lousy generals. You know, you're particularly harsh on Franks and also Ricardo Sanchez for their conduct of the, you know, of the Iraq War. Talk about Sanchez.
Ricardo Sanchez, to me, is a tragic figure. He was basically put in the job because he happened to be sitting around and available, not doing what George Marshall would have done, which is to say, what's the problem I'm facing? What's the best general to put in there? He goes in. Rumsfeld's not paying attention. He's bored with the war. Sanchez is the youngest, newest lieutenant general in the U.S. Army. He's not been prepared for it. They don't give him what he needs to fight, and he has no idea of how to conduct the fight anyways. On his watch, Iraq blows up into a large-scale insurgency. We have the Abu Ghraib mess, which was a great recruiting poster for the terrorist, and basically Iraq starts falling apart. And he's mad at the end of the year because he doesn't get promoted to a four-star.
That's a little different than the army of General Marshall.
Yeah. I mean, Marshall would have yanked him out of there. Marshall never would have put him in there, first of all. He would have said, you know, that Dave Petraeus guy up in northern Iraq, he's doing well. Let's move him down and make him the commander and have other people do what he's doing.
You know, throughout the book, you there are whole varieties of people who you have great admiration for. General William Dupuy, if I'm pronouncing his name right. You talk repeatedly about the School of Advanced Military Studies. You talk about, I believe, Colonel Yingling. Talk to me about some of these figures and what they tried to do and what happened to them.
One of my favorite characters in the book after George Marshall, who kind of dominates the book, is a Marine general, O.P. Smith, Oliver P. Smith. O.P. Smith is almost forgotten today, and one of the things I want to do in this book is say, hey, pay attention to O.P. Smith. For my money, perhaps the greatest division commander in American history. He's at the Chosin Reservoir, and he's the Marine commander. He's on the west side of the reservoir. The U.S. Army is on the east side.
This is in the Korean War.
This is the Korean War, November, December 1950. People forget the U.S. Army on the east side of the reservoir was wiped out. There was a reinforced regiment over there that took 80% casualties. That unit was smashed. Probably one of the biggest defeats in American history, much, much greater numbers than, say, were lost at Custer's last stand. The Marines are on the west side of the Chosin Reservoir. O.P. Smith, with his one reinforced Marine division, is surrounded by at least five or six Chinese divisions that have just attacked, despite General MacArthur telling President Truman that the Chinese would not intervene. And if they did, he'd wipe them out from the air. And so O.P. Smith is up there, and there was a good chance that his Marines could have been surrounded and wiped out if he had handled it badly. In fact, Omar Bradley, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time, told a Marine he thought that the Marines would be wiped out. And 15,000 Marines, it would have been the greatest disaster in American military history. But O.P. Smith was a very good general. The first thing a general does is the decisions he makes before the fight begins. He made a very important decision to have two airstrips built so he could fly out his wounded, because when you have to move, your wounded really slow you down. And also to fly in supplies, bullets, food, and medicine. So he has these airstrips available, and then he makes a second decision. I'm not going to try to keep a big, wide perimeter that could be penetrated by the Chinese. I'm going to keep a tight, close-in perimeter. That means giving up some high ground, but it also means nobody gets through my lines. He retreats very carefully. And he fights his way. This is the old, he has famously said, retreat hell, I'm just attacking in a different direction. He was actually making a point. It wasn't just Marine bravado. Usually when you retreat, you're going away from the enemy. In his retreat, he had to fight his way through a couple more Chinese divisions that were blocking the road. So it was a fighting retreat the whole way. It was a big battle. And might well be the best example of division command in battle in American history. The Marines didn't really appreciate it that much. O.P. Smith was kind of a cranky character. He retired. a few years later, he had a hard time buying a house. He never had owned a house and didn't have much money. Finally bought a house in California and gardened in his combat boots until he died, very quietly.
My guest is Thomas Ricks. His new book is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. You know, you said before that General MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, a figure of great legend in movies and so on and so forth, was one of the worst generals in American history, and Harry Truman fired him. What happened to MacArthur?
Sure, Douglas MacArthur was a piece of work. He must have been pretty good because he was insubordinate to three different American presidents, Herbert Hoover, Franklin Roosevelt, and Harry Truman. So he must have had something good going, but it's hard to see. I mean, first of all, he knows that Pearl Harbor has happened. He's commanding in the Philippines at the beginning of World War II, yet his planes are destroyed on the ground. He doesn't have a good disposition of troops, and he winds up losing a lot of people that he wouldn't necessarily have had to lose. Go on to Korea. He assures the president the Chinese will not invade, and then they do. He goes from being wildly over-optimistic, saying the war will be over by Christmas 1950, just 6 months into it, to wildly despairing and saying he has to abandon the peninsula. Finally, he gets fired, or he gets moved away. They put Ridgway in, and Ridgway turns that war around very quickly. But MacArthur's not finished. He basically thinks he's going to come back and be president. He speaks in baseball stadiums. He testifies before Congress. And finally, in 1952, he goes to the Republican National Convention in Chicago to deliver the keynote address. This was going to be like a king finally accepting his crown. The trouble was he gave a really lousy speech. Americans hadn't seen MacArthur close up, but MacArthur was this figure overseas. MacArthur did not come back to the United States from before World War II until he was fired during the Korean War, 14 or 15 years out of the country. When the president asked him to come back once, he said no, he was too busy. When Americans see MacArthur close up, they kind of see he's this really old windbag that doesn't have a lot to say. He does not get the Republican nomination. In fact, in one of the great ironies of history, the Republican Party gives the nomination to his former assistant, Dwight Eisenhower, who had been his chief of staff in the Philippines in the 1930s. And I think one reason Eisenhower agreed to run for president was to stop MacArthur from becoming president. Eisenhower did not think a lot of MacArthur. He refers to him in his diary as a big baby. A woman, when he was president, a woman once said to him, Mr. President, do you enjoy the theater? And Eisenhower responded, no, but I did study drama under MacArthur.
So what would you do now? What would you like to see the Army do now differently?
The first thing I'd like to do is see military tradition restored. Our military tradition, dating back 200 years, is to reward success in combat and to punish failure. Why do we do this? Because it's important to the soldiers who are being led. If you want to support your troops, give them good leaders, demand good leaders, insist on good leaders, and don't let the Army get away with saying, well, we're just trying to be fair to our officers. There's no such thing as fairness when it comes to officers because you're holding the lives of your troops in your hand. And so I don't care about fair, I care about success. The second thing is better preparation for these people. We don't just need trained generals, we need educated generals. We need generals who can think independently, who don't think that thinking is what something you hire somebody to do for you any more than discipline or leadership is something you hire people to do for you. So I would like to see in military education at our war colleges and so on, a return to the old principles, making it tough to get into those schools, making those schools rigorous with a lot of reading and writing, with class rankings released. So at the end of the year, people know who was number one in the class and who was number 365, and making it important that people say, give me one of those smart guys because I really need some good thinking here. Right now, instead, we have an army that can just bumble along rather quietly, not doing a whole lot in Afghanistan for 10 years, and just rotating people in and out where nobody really succeeds and nobody really fails, and the war is not anybody's problem.
You have heroes. You have people who you hold in very low esteem. But you know, how can we make some of these things happen? The Army is this enormous bureaucracy. There's tradition and history and politics of Congress, and don't let me get started on that. But how can you make some of these things happen?
Well, you need interest in it, which is one reason I wrote this book. You need people to understand the history. You need people in Congress who are interested. You need a White House and a president who are interested. And I don't think you'll see the politicians in the White House or the Congress interested unless the American people are interested. And that's actually one reason I support a resumption of the draft. Right now, people don't have skin in the game. It's not their war. If their kids are in the military, or if they think their kids might be in the military, they would demand better leadership. They would say, no, I'm not going to put up with some dumb general who thinks he's a heavy equipment operator. I want my kid led by the best we can get out there. And so if the people demand it, they'll talk to Congress about it. Congress and the White House will see, hey, we need to deal with this, and they will. I worry that instead, though, we're not going to do anything until we have a really big military disaster on our hands, a big lost battle, even a lost war. And then we begin thinking seriously about having a better military.
Well, the book is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. Thomas E. Ricks, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I hope people read it. They can go down to the bookstore or get it on Amazon.
Tom Ricks, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Goodbye.